welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hansen, the Morton and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to turn towards a piece that you wrote recently for American Greatness, in which you suggested we may be reaching what you call peak progressivism. And people may hear that phrase and think it means maximum progressivism, which is part of it. But you also mean it in a slightly more literal sense, which is it's an actual peak. It has gone as far as it can go, and it sort of has to start declining from here. We can talk about some of the indicators of that in a moment, but why don't we start with how we got here? There are a lot of people on the left who will tell you that at the end of the day, Barack Obama was more or less a centrist, disappointed a lot of hardcore progressives. But you argue here in this piece that A, Obama was a big part of how we got to this point, and B, that these days Obama himself might be insufficiently liberal for the hardcore left. Make that case for us.
Yeah, I think when Obama came onto the national scene in 2008, remember, he was against gay marriage. He said we had to close the border. You had to wait in line for your immigration turn. He didn't disagree with any of the policies in Afghanistan. The whole sort of democratic establishment line that we've heard before from all the way back to Hubert Humphrey. It was Bill Clintonism, a little bit to the left, because he actually beat Hillary Clinton in the primaries by going to the left. But by the time he left, we had 550 sanctuary cities. We had him weighing in on everything from Ferguson to Trayvon Martin to the Skip Gates psychodrama. We had Eric Holder talking about, as Attorney General, my people, or this is a nation of cowards. We had universal health care, supposedly. And we had this apology tour. We had the Iran deal. We had sort of a conscientious attempt in the Middle East to promote a Shia Persia theocratic Iran to balance our former allies, Israel and the Saudis and the Gulf monarchy. So there was a radical shift by the time he left. And that's kind of opened the floodgates, and people thought, you know, I don't have to be apologetic about being a progressive. Liberalism is dead. Obama sort of paved the way, and we can go beyond him in terms of abortion is legal, then maybe we can have infanticide if you have to have it. If you have open borders, then maybe we can give amnesty just by executive fiat. If we have reassembled the Middle East, maybe we can spy on the Netanyahu government and try to interfere in his reelection. That's what Obama did. And people took heart from that. They were encouraged by it. And he became sort of the father figure of the progressive revolution. And then, of course, revolutions always eat their own. So on the stage, Joe Biden, at least initially, took up that mantle, and then he sort of was pilloried from all sides. And then he kind of renounced it, and now we found out that the Republican primary voter is not quite his left wing, so he's reestablished himself as Obama's successor. But everything beyond Obama is what we're seeing now. Everybody's taking everybody, meaning the primary candidates and in the primaries, and the Democratic exegesis about issues. It's all taken to a degree far beyond what Obama thought he could get away with.
I'm interested in your diagnosis of identity politics in this piece, because your contention is that the left's idea of intersectionality, this concept of the interplay of these different kinds of oppression based on whatever demographic groups you belong to, your contention in this piece is that that is in practice a lie, that all of these ostensibly oppressed groups are really jockeying with each other for power, in some cases the power that comes from grievance, and that you've seen that throughout the course of the Democratic primary. So spell that out for us.
Well, I think there's two things going on simultaneously in the Democratic Party and the liberal movement itself. One is that Pete Buttigieg can't quite figure out why black voters don't like him and would not vote for him. And that's true in South Carolina is the most prominent example. And it was because they have a deep-seated suspicion of unapologetic homosexuality. And that's just a fact. It's not a slur. And everybody knows it, and nobody wants to talk about it. But under intersectionality, they're supposed to be part of a unified movement. And That's one thing that's going on, just to give one example. But at the same time, there was a backlash, I guess, I don't want to say white male voters, but moderates. So to great fanfare, this whole thing started out with a blast that we had Julian Castro and we had Cory Booker and Deval Patrick and Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand and Amy Klobuchar and Andrew Yang, and this was the other. And then we got rid of these mediocre white male candidates, two or three of them. And then Kamala Harris and these people were supposed to take over the party. And what we ended up with was three old white guys in their late 70s, Joe Biden and Mayor Mike Bloomberg and, of course, Bernie Sanders. And what happened to intersectionality, and the voters did this, but according to their own statutes of proportional representation and disparate impact, you'd have thought the Democratic Party would have said, well, whether the voters liked it or not, they're implicitly biased, and we're going to bring Kamala back, or we're going to put Julian on the final debate stage. They didn't do that. And so what we ended up with, for all the blast of intersectionality, it ended with a whimper, not a bang. And the whimper was three old white guys. And they were, the rest of the candidates were squabbling about who was more victimized or who was more authentically non-white. And then they ended up choosing, they meaning Democrats, the most white, the whitest candidates you could find.
You talk in this piece about the sort of cultural dimensions of peak progressivism, in addition to the political ones. And one field that you highlight as really having reached its saturation point with this kind of high-octane progressivism is the American university. Why do you think of it as approaching a breaking point on college campuses?
Well, because before it was just ideologically perverse. In other words, everybody knew that 95% of the faculty were not only left-wing, but at least in the humanities and social science, actively proselytizing people instead of instructing them. But structurally, the university was considered sacrosanct. And by that, I mean tuition was manageable. But in the last 30 years, tuition has doubled each year faster than the rate of inflation, at a time when these universities, the top 100, have these multi-billion dollar endowments, at the time when we have 1.6 trillion in aggregate student debt, at a time when the number of administrators is increased about three times faster than the number of faculty, and the number of faculty have actually, in terms of tenured positions, decreased. And what I'm getting at, Troy, is that basically, if you look at it this way, the U.S. government is subsidizing moral hazard by telling students, go to college and we will back your loans. The university has no responsibility to tell the student which major or which course of study is remunerative and will pay back their debts and which will not. They don't tell the student X amount of your bill is for administrators, X amount for teaching, X amount for social justice activities. And you add it all up, and what you're left with is this progressive left-wing institution that exploits part-time teachers, it exploits students, it leaves them with debt. And we all know what the answer is. It's just simply, if you want to have a college, you want to raise your rates so fast, you accept moral hazard, and the universities back the loans. If you back the loans, then you'd be mean and lean. You would have fewer administrators, less politically active teachers, accountability, etc. And so for a progressive institution, it's really regressive. And I think people are understanding that now, that the endowments are not used. Only about half the budget goes to student loans and student affairs. And the universities are not open. I guess you could say it would be no overstatement to say the first, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh amendments are not viable on campuses. So it's a regressive, reactionary institution, like a lot of revolutionary movements end up as. It reminds me of sort of Castroite philosophy around 1995 or something.
Well, to that point, from your piece, here are some of the traits you see as emblematic of the rot in progressivism. Your words here: iconoclasm, Trotskyization, that's not one you say very often, and Puritanism. That's quite a mix. Where do you see those traits expressing themselves in American life?
Well, I'm looking out the window at Stanford University, and they have changed the name of the mall right below the tower. It was at one time Junipero Serra Mall for the great late 17th, early 18th century missionary who founded the California mission system. And we found out he whipped Indians to make them obey his efforts at what he called a civilizing mission. So we just erased his name. Now, we don't do it, as we've talked about earlier, we never really do it where it matters. I mean, nobody's going to object that it's no longer Serra Boulevard Mall or whatever, but they are going to object if you did it with Stanford, who had a much more transparent record of saying some pretty awful things and exporting Chinese laborers, but nobody's going to change it to, as we said, Chumash University. So they try to change names or statues. They do it at Yale and Harvard, but not the name Yale or Harvard. So it's hard to take them quite seriously. We do know that certain people then get their names wiped out. I'm thinking of Bolt Law School. You know, it's a very distinguished UC Berkeley's premier law school on the West Coast. It's no longer called Bolt Law School because Bolt Hall, Bolt was, by today's standards, illiberal. So we've just erased him from the popular memory. And we do that with the cancel culture, too. I mean, Al Franken ceased to exist, two days ago, Chris Matthews ceased to exist in about 20 seconds. He just went out and said, you know, I'm guilty as charged of saying insensitive comments. I'm kind of old. And he walked off the set. And one day is $20 million a year. The guy, the go-to guy, the most influential left-wing, I don't know, pundit. And the next day, he doesn't exist. So it's kind of like 1984. We've talked about that before. And that's sort of what the university does now. And it's, I think, like the French Revolution and Robespierre and his cadre, it's a mirage. If somebody had the guts to say, I'm not leaving, or I'm going to sue you, or I'm not changing this name, or a college president like S.I. Hayakawa got on top of a car and pulled the plug out of a speaker in the free speech area that was illegally blasting into classrooms messages, I think it would vanish, because I don't think it has a rationale. It's logical, and people are sick of it. And that's one of the reasons that Joe Biden is the nominee, or at least he's the leading nominee now in a way that he wasn't before. People got sick of it, and they thought, you know what? He's kind of crazy. He's kind of enfeebled, but he's at least sane in the sense of being a moderate Democrat compared to the alternative. And that's what got Trump elected. And like the Bourbons, they don't remember anything, and they don't learn anything, they being the liberal media, because they keep doing it and they don't realize the effect that they're having on people, and the university doesn't realize the effect that they're having on people. And the prestige and the reputation of the university has really descended. When I go places, I don't tell people I work at Stanford. 30 years ago, if you said I was a Stanford professor, I'm a tenured fellow, they would think, wow, that's so prestigious. Now it's just a joke. It really is. Like, outside the elite, you know.
When we're diagnosing the maladies afflicting progressivism right now, I mean, we tend to think of progressivism as expressing itself either through discrete policy issues or through cultural impulses. But there's another aspect that you talk about in the piece, which is the progressive attitude towards American political institutions themselves, towards the Constitution and the very design of our system of government. Explain that.
That takes place in two ways, one more culturally and informal, and one formal and legalistic. And of course, the informal and cultural is the 1619 project that says that the country was really founded when the first slave landed here, and it was based on racism. And the constant assault, when you saw on the Democratic stage where Bernie Sanders said this is inherently a racist country, blah, blah, blah. But I think scarier is these lawsuits or these efforts. I think almost every single one of the original 18 Democratic candidates called for the abolition of the Electoral College without any knowledge of the Founding Fathers or the Federalist Papers, the principle behind it. And when you start looking in legal journals and articles or popular media, you see there's a movement to recalibrate the U.S. Senate so it's more like the House. Why does Montana or Wyoming get, you know, 250,000 people get their own senator, and we in California have to have 10 million to earn a Senate seat? And when you look at what's happened with these primaries with multiple day voting, so Buttigieg and Klobuchar were still on the ballot, even though people had voted earlier for them, and then they were virtual candidates. They didn't exist when the polls closed. And so I think there's an attempt to change the Constitution. We see it with the First Amendment, that trigger warnings, censorship on campus, banning books again. These are all anti-First Amendment efforts. And I think a lot of people, when you poll students, they don't believe in the First Amendment. They surely don't believe in the Second Amendment. And Beto O'Rourke said he would be the czar that would be responsible for taking away guns, from particular type of guns, from particular types of people. So there's a formal effort, movement, what agenda, that the Constitution was written by a bunch of old white guys that were slave owners, and it doesn't deserve the respect and sanctity that we bestow it with, and the best thing to do is just junk it or change it so it's unrecognizable. The biggest thing was packing a court. Remember that when Trump got his two picks, that became an issue in the early Democratic primaries, or I should say the debates. And I think all of the candidates again endorsed a court packing scheme. That used to be FDR's great shame, that he, 1937 or 8, he wanted to pack the court to make sure it favored the New Deal. And now, even though that's been there, the number of nine justices has been there right after the Civil War for 150 years, they want to change that and add new slots and thereby new liberal judges. The only common denominator here is that when the things don't go their way, they want to change the system because they don't have confidence in the existing system. So they don't think they can win the Electoral College again, or they're not sure they can defeat Trump and then get their own person in there to pick Supreme Court judges. So they want to change everything. It shows an inherent lack of confidence in their ability to enact an agenda.
So final question, Victor. Donald Trump has boxed Democrats in a way, in that his views on trade and immigration and even entitlements have given him an entree to traditionally Democratic working class constituencies that Republicans haven't had a solid grasp on in a long time. So one can understand how in that world, the more affluent white-collar liberals begin to occupy the dominant position within the Democratic Party. So the question from that, were Democrats to back off from the intense progressivism of a Bernie Sanders or an AOC, where do they go politically given where Trump has put them? Where is there room for them?
That's a good point, because ironically, I think Trump has given them no room. Because I was talking to a Mexican-American law enforcement officer, and he just said something that was so strange. He said, "Why do they hate all you white guys?" He was talking about listening to a debate. And I said, "Hate us?" And he said, "Well, that's all they talk about is white privilege and racism, which they hate you guys more than I hate you guys." He was laughing about that. And I think even minorities are shocked about this elite white guilt and the fobbing off of culpability on this deplorable, irredeemable dregs of society class. And Trump just walked, he just took them to the cleaners. He just said, you know, these are the states where the elections are decided, in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Florida, but especially Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, Iowa. I'm going to take them. And here the four or five issues are, you know, manufacturing, get tough with China, close the border, deregulate, and in political correctness. And he stole their old constituency, and then they decide, well, we can't win them back because we've got this new race, class, gender constituency. And I think they're learning that if you get everybody out to vote and you get a once-in-a-lifetime candidate like Obama, and you have a once-in-a-lifetime terrible candidate like Romney and John McCain, and you have a once-in-a-lifetime black swan event like the 2008 meltdown that gets you an entree, or the Iraq War, then you can pull it off. But other than that, i.e. 99% of the time, you can't. You got a Hillary Clinton, you can't do it. You got Biden, you can't do it. But they have to be taught that, and the way they're taught that is to lose another election or two.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VD Hanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.